Hello, it's Tom here. We've got a brilliant episode of Last Orders for you today. But before we get into that, I just want to quickly remind you all about Spiked Supporters. This is our thriving donor community for those of you who give to Spiked regularly. So now those who give £5 or more each month or £50 or more each year can get exclusive perks. You can comment on articles, you can get discounts on all items in our shop, and you can get free and discounted tickets to Spiked events. So if you'd like to come along to any of our upcoming events, which we'll be announcing soon, and you're not already a Spiked supporter, then why not sign up today? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to find out more and to sign up. Once again, that's spiked-online.com/supporters. Thanks so much. And now on with the show. Welcome to Last Orders, a Spiked podcast all about freedom, the nanny state, and censorship. In this episode, we discuss living with COVID, Jimmy Carr's latest controversy, and the law of unintended consequences. Hello, and welcome to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, and I'm joined this month, as I am every month, by the IEA's Chris Snowden. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Tom. Hi, listeners.
And we're delighted to be joined, a returning guest to the show, a friend of the show, Dominic Frisby, writer, comedian, problematic troubadour, and many other things. Thanks so much for coming back.
Problematic troubadour, that's a good moniker. I like that. Thank you. Hello, Tom.
We aim to please. So we should kick off by talking about COVID, which I say with a bit of a whimper because it does feel like it's kind of over in this country, Chris. I mean, Boris Johnson, under a fair bit of political duress, which we might get into, has announced that the restrictions, all of the restrictions, basically, including the legal requirement to self-isolate when you test positive, will be going in pretty short order. There's even been the devolved administrations, Wales, etc., has effectively said that they are going to remove most of their restrictions quite soon, you know, probably about 2 weeks after they suggested it would be genocidal to do so or whatever. So it does feel like it's coming to an end, at least in the UK. But what is your sense of it right now? Is this the right time? Too late? Will this be the final relaxation? What do you think is going to happen?
Yeah, well, it's all over, just like we said in October. It's time to put it to rest. As I said in my classic Spiked article, it's time to put COVID behind us. About a week before the Omicron variant was discovered. Well, you know, variants may come along again. It's hard to see us getting in much more trouble with this now. I'm not sure, to be honest with you, you know, call me a nanny sex, I'm not sure if it's the right time to get rid of all the self-isolation stuff. I think it probably is in legal terms, but it would be quite useful if the government, like, set out a clearer message.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Because they keep changing the rules all the time, it's very hard to know what the government thinks you're supposed to do or indeed what you're obliged to do. I haven't really heard a clear message from government saying, if you get COVID, stay at home still.
Yeah,
we're not going to fine you £10,000, but do stay at home because it's still, you know, a thing. So I think, yeah, it's probably going to be okay. I mean, Omicron is not much worse than a cold, really. No, not much worse than flu, I suppose. Let's not exaggerate this. But it's not, it's not going to make the health service collapse. It's been incredible if you look at the number of cases around Europe, especially like in Denmark, but also in Israel, France. You know, you think we had a lot of cases in Christmas. Look at these. They had like four times as many cases. And yet still the health service is pretty much been able to cope with it. They've got better health services, obviously, because they've got the NHS. But still, I think it shows that even if there is another wave of this, and even if it's much worse than anything we've had before, it still won't be that bad because Omicron is just less inherently dangerous and the vaccines and the boosters have worked really well. So, yeah, I think it's time. It's been 2 years, for Christ's sake. You know what I mean?
It's easy to forget that.
I think it's, in a way, I wish we'd nailed some people's colours to the mask in like December 2020 when the vaccine started being rolled out. Yeah. I read something by Will Hutton in The Observer recently, which he was saying this is libertarian madness to get rid of the restrictions at this point. It's like, it's been 2 years, man. And, you know, Independence Age and all these kind of, you know, admittedly a dwindling rump of, you know, kind of paranoid opinion. But I bet if you'd ask these people in December 2020, where do you think we'll be by February 2022? I don't think any of them really would have been saying, well, we need to vaccinate 5-year-olds before we can do anything else. And we still should be wearing face masks everywhere. You know, I just, surely these, even these people would have said, well, yeah, definitely back to normal by then, for God's sake. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, it's well over a year away. So 2 years more than enough of this. And, you know, just being tired of something isn't reason to stop doing anything about it. But the fact that it just is clearly not any real threat to the health service. And in some ways now, actually, the measures are more of a threat to the health service. Yeah, I think we should put it behind us until the next variant comes along. We'll have to panic again. No, seriously, I don't think that's going to happen.
Am I right in saying, and you two are both obviously virologists, qualified virologists,
yeah,
but the viruses get weaker over time? Each variant is likely to be less, it spreads more because that's good for the virus, but it's less harmful on the person it occupies.
Yeah, in theory, yeah. Although with COVID, there's never really been any good reason to expect that to actually happen because...
Well, it has happened with Omicron.
It has happened, but
or
I think...
To use the correct pronunciation, Omicron.
Is that right?
I have no idea.
But I'm not sure that is a... I don't think there's anything inevitable about that. I'd always assumed that it came from Delta. I think we said in the show a while ago that it had gone through some HIV patient and it was like a really mad mutation. And the fact that it mutated in such a mad way had also happened to make it less severe, but less virulent. But the fact that there's such a big gap between getting infected and having symptoms means that there never really was much of an evolutionary reason for it to become milder. It wasn't like it was killing people before they could transmit it. So I think we, to some extent, we got quite lucky with Omicron, and apparently it didn't actually evolve from the Delta variant. It apparently evolved from the original Wuhan variant, which was still knocking around somewhere. Mm. So I've heard anyway, but carry on, please.
Well, I mean, in any case, I think COVID is over. I think Omicron is the best thing that could have possibly happened.
Are you going to keep calling it?
Yes, well, I do. Somebody has to stand up for principles, Chris, as you know.
Microaggressing against the Greek alphabet all this time without realizing it. That's terrible.
It was the best thing that could have happened because it was highly infectious and ultimately mild. I had it myself over Christmas and, you know, I just had a bad tempered couple of days where I lacked motivation. And had I not tested positive, I would have just thought I had a hangover. So it's the best thing that could have happened in terms of bringing herd immunity and all the rest of it. I think, again, accidentally, the UK is in a brilliant position, largely thanks to all the backbenchers of the Conservative Party who put Boris Johnson under enormous pressure not to lock down. He didn't. Our outcomes actually proved to be better than countries that did lock down, whether Scotland or Wales or countries on the continent. So we now have the proven example that not locking down actually has benefits. I think we're in a better place mentally than they are on the continent where they've locked down. And for numerous different reasons, I think the disease itself could be argued to be over, or the worst is over. The people who are going to die from it have already died. Everyone else is vaccinated. Who wants to be? If the vaccinations do actually work, if the vaccines do actually work, well, we're all vaccinated. So I just don't think there is an excuse to take the measures that were previously taken. But as I know you both are keen readers of my book, Daylight Robbery, Chris actually genuinely has read it.
Last time you're on the show.
I've never stopped talking about it. But one of the examples of a crisis is that, and a government's reaction to a crisis is that when the crisis occurs, whether it's a war or a pandemic or an economic financial crisis, as in 2008, government is able to do things, or the state is able to do things that it would not be able to do in peacetime. Quantitative easing, impose higher taxes, lock down the economy, whatever it is. And the evidence is, the IFS calls this the ratchet effect. When the crisis has passed, the government controls never go back to the level that they were before the crisis began. And that is my biggest concern. Mm. I still think, even with everything that's happened, even if no COVID no longer exists, you know, people are still going to have to wear masks in certain situations, or there will be still people who wear masks out of their own volition. And that's just one example. And there will always be this lingering threat, you know, the medical dictatorship, as my friend calls it, my anarchic friend, now has powers that it didn't previously have. And, you know, with a bit of data and a bit of pressure, it can do stuff that we wouldn't want it to do. So that concerns me. And the sooner that we can, that, you know, SAGE and all its modelling can be not only debunked and ridiculed as it is now, but actually never have any influence on government policy again, while it's still using these existing techniques with these existing personnel, the better.
I mean, you do hope that, because I share a lot of those concerns, Dom, definitely. And also just the kind of legitimacy that's been given to these previously unthinkable measures is going to be quite hard to shake. But it does feel as if, whilst the kind of lockdown fanatics might have won the war, it feels like the peace is still very much up for discussion. I mean, the swiftness with which a lot of people in the UK seem to have snapped back to normal in a way that I might not have expected, in terms of not being as cautious, not being as in favour of some of these restrictions, even though it's a whole other can of worms. But even this truckers protest is kind of a kind of sense of frustration. It's very complicated. There's a lot of anti-vax sentiment in it and all the rest of it. But this kind of general sense of frustration about you're continuing to pile these measures on even after the emergency has passed. But so it, one can note that whilst there's always going to be those kind of elements of that kind of legislation hanging around, or at least that state muscle memory being there, it does feel like the mood is different, Chris, at this point.
Oh, massively different. Yeah, I mean, amongst normal people, it's. I mean, it's. I haven't really noticed the restrictions since last May, to be perfectly honest with you. Once the snooker club was back open again, I was fine. I know you were still rule of six in some pubs and a bit of mask wearing. Yeah. And there was a little bit of mask wearing for like 6 weeks or something in the winter. I find it staggering. I see these people on Twitter who seem like they're still basically living behind the sofa. And then I guess if you're that kind of person, you're going to be on Twitter more than average. Yeah. But the normal people, yeah, there's still the odd person you see wearing a mask outside. And I stress the word odd because you look at me and go, what the hell? What are you doing?
I did Lee Hurst's gig the other day.
Oh, yeah.
And Lee Hurst actually threw someone out of the club for wearing a mask.
That's the most Lee Hurst story of all time. That's wonderful.
Keep Britain free.
I mean, Dom mentioned the modelling there, Chris. Do you think there's going to be a kind of reckoning with the scientific advice? I mean, you wrote this great piece for Spikes in recent weeks talking about how, I think you said over the past year in particular, every time the government got something right, it did so by going against what the sage advice was. Do you think there's going to be, as I say, some sort of reckoning with sage, the role of expertise in politics, all the rest of it after this? Is it all just going to be buried?
It's nice to think, isn't it? Yeah, I would hope that when the inquiry, or probably inquiries, kick off, and they're going to go on for the rest of the decade, probably, I hope they do look at the likes of sage. I don't think they will. I think it will be mainly about trying to apportion blame and looking for examples of fraud and stuff like that, which is fair enough. But I hope they do look at the kind of the counterfactual of what would happen if we had lockdown, like these people clearly wanted us to do. And I know they say that it's doing projected, but bollocks. They were, particularly just before Christmas, it was very, very clear these models were designed to bounce us into a lockdown. And I think we need to be, A, thankful, like Dominic says, that you know, Boris resisted that. And it took real strength to resist that. If you can remember what things were like a few days before Christmas, there was intense pressure on him to, you know, avoid these 6,000 deaths a day that were supposedly going to come along. You know, it was a brave call, to be honest with you, to do that.
I don't think it was brave. I think he did it to save his own skin.
Because of the backbenchers.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Well,
and the longer, like ever since Boris was elected, you could look at some of the big decisions he had to make early on, things like HS2 and lockdown and so on. And in my view, almost every big decision he had to make, he chose the wrong one. But since his job has been under threat from the backbenchers of the Tory party, he's got every decision he's had to make right. So I don't care whether he's making the right decision for the wrong reasons, as long as he makes the right decision.
Yeah.
And so I just hope that we're in kind of a really good position now where, you know, if you don't take the, you know, the free market libertarian option, we're going to sack you.
Yeah.
We're writing letters.
He needs to have his back to the wall.
And while he's in that position, you know, we can win the peace.
Because his Operation Red Meat was great stuff, wasn't it? Like when he realised he needed to put out some decent popular policies, it was like, we're going to scrap the BBC and stuff. Oh, wow, this is more like it. Give me more red meat.
Sure. And exactly. And by the way, we're going to
Operation
talk about
Save Big Dog.
My new
almost forgotten about that
theory, theory is that you can tell somebody's politics by the food they eat and the diet they do. And so, for example, if you look at people who are trying to lose weight, right-wingers or libertarians, whatever word you want to go, will always choose protein diets, red meat diets, those kind of ones. What's the one you call? And whereas the left
paleo,
that kind of, you know, high protein, masculine kind of food. And the left wing will always choose the sort of vegan-y kind of option. It's quite an interesting, you know, like, for example, you can tell somebody's politics by the kind of buildings they like. I think you can also tell somebody's politics by the food they eat.
Before we get into a very divisive discussion about brutalism or something like this, we should probably move on to a very unlibertarian thing that the government has done. So recently, Nadine Dorries waded into this outrage over Jimmy Carr's Netflix special, even suggesting that the government might regulate Netflix to try and make sure that such offensive comedy wouldn't happen again. So it's reopened this big discussion. I mean, ordinarily, you know, Jimmy Carr tells offensive joke is not a headline, but apparently it is in the age that we live in. And this government have said that they're desperate to do something about it. So, I mean,
and a month and a half after he told it.
Exactly.
I mean, I suppose I'm sure many people will have listening to this will have been almost bored of this story by now, such as it was so ridiculous. But it was essentially a joke about the Holocaust and about gypsies. Jimmy Carr saying that one thing they never talk about in the Holocaust is the gypsies who died. It's again this kind of misdirection. You think he's making almost this quite worthy point, and then he says they don't want to talk about the positives. I'm butchering it, of course. But as you say, Dom, just gets clipped, put on the internet, and suddenly there's a whole big moral panic about it. What did you make about this? What did you make of that joke? He really hasn't changed that much over the years, has he? Is it just that the world's changed around him?
Well, the world has changed and around him. But Jimmy's comedy has always been, you know, pushing the boundaries of taste to the very limit. And the skill of the comedian is, you know, particularly when you're doing stuff that's on the edge, you've got to be doubly sure it's funny, because it's when it's not funny that it falls into bad taste. And, you know, I watched that joke and, you know, it made me laugh. I wouldn't have done that joke myself, because you can sort of, if you deconstruct the joke, it was basically a joke at Gypsy's expense, which is not the kind of comedy that I like to do. But, you know, I watched the joke and I didn't see the punchline coming, and it made me laugh.
Almost by sheer brutality.
But I mean, that's the skill in joke. In telling a joke, you send somebody one way and then take them somewhere else. So just from the technicalities of comedy, I would say it was, you know, it was a good joke. I wouldn't have done it. But never underestimate Jimmy Carr. He has an extraordinary ability to push boundaries. And we made this documentary about the history of the Edinburgh Festival, and Jimmy was in it a couple of years ago, and he was quoting Ayn Rand at me in the documentary and so on. So Jimmy's well aware of the sort of arguments that we'll be making, but I don't think he's interested in doing political comedy in his act, but he's well aware. And you know, he's an entrepreneur, Jimmy. He champions people who, you know, rather than having a job in a company all your life, go and start up a business and be an entrepreneur and all that. He's a big champion of all that. So I think he's probably philosophically in favor of free speech and free markets and all the rest of it. But yeah, it was a good joke. I wouldn't have done it. And I think we're in a culture war at the moment, and people on the other side of the culture war are getting their knickers in a twist in order to take down one of their potential enemies.
I mean, it doesn't matter whether it was a good joke or not. A lot of the discussion about this in the media has been like, well, I didn't really find it funny myself. But I mean, it doesn't matter whether you think it's a good joke. The audience laughed their heads off. I'm not sure it was a good joke. I need to see it in context, to be quite honest with you. I can't say I laughed at it having seen it clipped on Twitter, but in the context of the whole thing, when he'd got into his persona and all that, I probably would have.
And the special was explicitly about this is the most almost extreme stuff.
Yeah, it's called His Dark Material. He's renowned as being like the master of sick jokes.
That is why he's always going to see him.
The setup is even career-ending jokes and all that, which is quite impressive, as it turns out.
But it doesn't matter. It could be a rubbish joke. You know, I mean, I'm not a massive fan of Chubby Brown. He says the odd thing. I'm quite funny. I found most of it
quite
particularly witty at all. And sometimes racist. But it doesn't matter. You should have the right to make jokes, whether they're good or bad. That obviously shouldn't come into it. What obviously concerns me is the Nadine Dorris thing, which I found genuinely sinister, what she said about it. I can't remember word for word what she said. But it was along the lines of, we don't have the power to stop this stuff being broadcast yet, but we will soon, is what she said. This is really worrying stuff. And it goes alongside the so-called online safety bill, which is as it stands now, poses an incredible threat to free speech by telling these platforms to take off speech that is legal but harmful.
Yeah.
I mean, what kind of Orwellian stuff is this, you know?
But the
if it's that bad, make it illegal. If it's not harmful, speech cannot be harmful, whatever happened to sticks and stones. And if it's legal, then it should be legal on any platform. In actual fact, there's too much speech that is already illegal. But making stuff that's legal, effectively illegal, without making it legal is weird, for one thing, but extremely draconian. And all this stuff needs to be pushed back at very hard. I think it's probably the biggest threat to freedom in this country for the next few years.
I offer solace. Peter Thiel's famous for making this argument in his essay, The Education of a Libertarian, back in 2008. And he argued that you can't achieve political change through political activism and political lobbying and so on and so forth. It's just too slow and drawn out a process. The way to achieve political change is through new technology and new frontiers. And technology has a solution. You know, I'm a big champion of Bitcoin. And one of the things about Bitcoin is it's censorship-free money. You don't need to go through banking controls and all the rest of it to get a Bitcoin account. You know, anyone can use it. All you need is an internet connection. And the principles of blockchain and decentralized technology are being applied to other, you know, social media. And so you are seeing the emergence of decentralized social media. They haven't quite got it working yet. But once you have decentralized social media, i.e. a form of social media of which nobody is in charge, no single body is in charge. So there is no corporate headquarters. Mm-hmm. There is no Facebook that is in charge of the decentralized social media. It is decentralized all over the world. So you can't, you literally can't close it down. You can make it illegal, but you can't close it down. Once we have that, then free speech will have free reign.
Is that what's going to happen? Yeah, how do we stop it being closed down?
Decentralized. Yeah. Social, because who do you close it down? Who do you?
Well, I don't like know, if you wanted I can't to close, imagine what it is.
If you wanted to close, is it an app or what?
Is it a website?
Well, if you wanted to close down Bitcoin, because Bitcoin is run on, you know, however many it is, 10,000, whatever it is, different computers down the world. If you want to close down Bitcoin, you know, where's the whole principle of it is that it was a form of money that has no central.
Sure, yeah, I get that.
How do you close down Bitcoin? You can make it illegal,
yeah,
but you can't close it down.
Well, isn't making it illegal quite a big
problem? No, because everyone, you just drive it into the black market and people still use it anyway.
But is there equivalent?
In fact, the evidence is in countries that they've made Bitcoin illegal, its usage has increased.
But is there an equivalent to that for YouTube or WhatsApp?
They're trying it. Signal is the closest thing with WhatsApp, and there is decentralized messaging. There's one called BitChute, which is sort of supposed to be a decentralized YouTube. It doesn't quite work. The problem with video sharing is the enormous amount of bandwidth that you need and computer storage to store all
but
this
also
stuff.
The government can block any website it wants, right? It's like Sci-Hub.
Presumably.
I can't use Sci-Hub anymore because the government's forced.
Sure, but you just block. Go, then you just start using Tor.
Right.
So, you know, there are always ways around it, but most people don't know how to download and use Tor.
Right.
What I'm saying is it's computer programmers who actively, you know, distrust government, don't like government controls, believe in individual liberty and free speech and all the rest of it, are, you know, experimenting with and designing ways to find it. And decentralized social media, it's closer than we think.
We shall see. I mean, I suppose the worry is that you almost get a free internet for people who know their way around the kit and then a kind of censored internet for everyone else.
Yeah, I mean, but if you take a look at Bitcoin, I mean, Bitcoin was so geeky and techy at first, but now...
I mean, it has exploded, you see.
It's only been 10 years and you know, it's so user-friendly now.
Mm.
So, you know, it will happen, but it's just not straight away. But yeah, new technology will save us.
Just before we move on to the final topic, I mean, why are the Tories so shit on this question, like where freedom of speech is concerned? I mean, they really jumped on this Jimmy Carr story.
Because they're scared.
I mean, because they will get this.
They're but, weak, you know, and you they're had, scared and they lack first principles.
Because you had Oliver Dowden like this week, sure. I think, giving another one of his kind of anti-woke, pro-free speech interventions and all the rest of it. But as you say, Chris, this online harms bill, as far as I understand it, it would basically make your own social media presence subject to regulation in the same way that like a TV station would be. It's like Ofcom regulated.
It's worse than that because they want to effectively monitor direct messaging, including WhatsApp.
They've tacked everything.
I hate WhatsApp, as you know, but one advantage of WhatsApp is it's encrypted at both ends, isn't it, right? So nobody can see it. Whereas I guess your Twitter DM, somebody could look at them from Twitter if they wanted to. But the government wants to not only effectively ban doubly encrypted messages or however you want to describe them, but it then will force the tech companies to police them to make sure you're not saying anything naughty. And however this legislation is worded in the end, you know that these tech companies are going to gold plate it because they're going to err on the side of caution.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I hope Dominic is right that some, you know, pirates are going to create some version of these things that can't be policed. But I do worry about the network effects. You know, there's people being trying to set up alternatives to Twitter and stuff. And the trouble is, you only get people who've been kicked off the other platforms.
Yeah, that's a really important point, the network effect. And, you know, it's really hard for anyone to challenge YouTube just because its network is so enormous and it's so established. That it is almost the biggest barrier, the network effect.
So let's move on to some typically nanny state stories, in particular, Chris. It's a great example here of the kind of law of unintended consequences, I guess. So it was a story from Seattle, involves the sugar tax, but I want to give the punchline of this story to you. So do you want to explain to us what actually happened?
Okay, so they brought in a sugar tax in Seattle, just the city of Seattle. I think for a start off, one of the unintended consequences, which is quite common when you have citywide sugar taxes in America, is that people didn't do their shopping in Seattle anymore. And they went to nearby suburbs and so on to buy their by their pop, and they also did the rest of their shopping there. That happened also in Philadelphia and Berkeley and a few other places. But the more amusing substitution effect, really, was that sales of beer went up. And some academics looked at this, and they used a control town that didn't have a sugar tax, and they found that Seattle's beer sales went up by more than in the control. Not entirely unexpected. This is the first study that's actually proven that this happens, but it's been suspected this kind of thing happens before. We've certainly seen in numerous studies that sales of fruit juice and milkshakes and other sweet products, including even in some instances actual sweet food. You know, you wouldn't think that like a chocolate bar is a direct substitute for a sugary drink, but it does seem as if people have kind of an inherent, almost subconscious desire for a certain amount of sweetness or sugar in their lives. And so even though they're not consciously deciding to drink less Coca-Cola mm-hmm. and eat more marathons, what marathons? I'm so Snickers. Then they do it anyway. So the upshot is that beer, even though beer is more heavily taxed than the soda, of course, people drank more, which is great from my perspective and from the brewer's perspective, but probably not what the public health people wanted to see. And it's just yet another unintended consequence of people who don't think out what's going to happen and how people actually behave. And it's a bit like the COVID modeling before, right? One of the big flaws is it didn't look at how people behaved.
Yeah.
And I just assumed that everybody would just do what they
just carry on as normal.
They normally do. Yeah. So you're dealing with these kind of nerds in their ivory towers with no idea how people behave. There's an amusing example in Mexico where they don't have very good water in Mexico. One of the promises of the president when he brought in his sugar tax, his soda tax, was he was going to use the money to spend on cleaning up the water supply, which, of course, he never did. Just went into the bloody, general coffers. And there was this study, again, from economists, and they're the most reliable people to do these studies. Public health people are useless. But the economists looked at this, and they found an increase in stomach bugs, essentially, after the tax came in, because, some people actually were cutting down on their consumption of fizzy drinks, but they were drinking the local water, and that made them quite a lot iller than they would have been from drinking the fizzy drinks. In Scotland, minimum pricing, what have you seen there? Well, alcohol-related deaths gone up actually a lot in 2020. You know, that's more to do with lockdown and the pandemic than anything else. But what you have seen is a big shift away from cider towards Buckfast. So people are, instead of drinking strong cider, they're drinking strong wine with caffeine in it, which is not necessarily a change for the best in terms of health or indeed crime disorder.
Dominic, what do you make of all of this? And the fact that they never seem to see these unintended consequences coming, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, the most famous sort of classic example is not so much on the unintended consequence front. It's the only measuring what you see and not measuring what you don't see. And there's the famous, I don't know if you know this, Chris will know it, the broken window theory and the Bastiat example, which is that if you throw a brick through somebody's window, well, then that guy who's got the broken window then has to hire a glazer to repair the window. And that's good because his money goes to the glazer and the glazer then spends the money somewhere else. And, the economy benefits. But then what you don't take into account with that measurement is the fact that you don't measure what the guy would have spent that money on had he not broken the window. And if you follow the logic, we should all go around throwing bricks through people's windows to help the economy. That's the sort of a summary. Is that a fair summary?
Yes, it's all opportunity cost.
Opportunity cost. And a lot of this modelling just doesn't include the opportunity cost. And I mean, we've seen so many regulations, stupid laws brought in, from like not having people sit on park benches during the lockdown and closing tennis courts and stupid things like that. And we've got a classic example. My friend overdid it in the gym last week and ended up having a heart attack. And so he's been in and out of hospital, and he had some problems today, and he went into the hospital and he texted me from the hospital. I was texting him to see if he was all right. And he goes, in the waiting room, in A&E, in the hospital, they've got rid of all the chairs because they didn't want people sitting next to each other, in case of infecting COVID. So now everyone in A&E waiting room is, and you think you're in A&E, surely, and that's one time you need to sit down. Mm. And then now in the A&E waiting room, instead of sitting next to each other, everyone's just standing next to each other. That's so incredible. It hasn't made any difference whatsoever. And it's just an example of dumb health and safety thinking that has actually made the situation worse. Mm. And then you look at things like, mandatory masks and all the mask wearing. And, I read a stat that masks take 5,000 years to degrade. And you see these masks, these mountains of masks in rubbish dumps and so on. And you just think, what is the environmental cost of all this mask wearing? when it's not even clear, you know, the efficacy of masks is disputed in any case.
Mm. I mean, it did sort of spell the end of the panic about single-use plastics, didn't it? The pandemic.
Temporarily. Everyone loved it. I think it's the, and the lateral flows as well.
Of course, yeah. No.
Millions and millions and millions of them.
But it just makes you realise.
From China as well.
It makes you realise how hypocritical and inconsistent regulation and government policy is, because on the one hand they give it the big one about plastics and this, that and the other, but then when it suits them they use it to the nth degree.
Mm-hmm. And Chris, just to sort of close this out, do you think surely that the pandemic and the very ridiculous kind of minute regulation of everyday life, you know, these long laws talking about, you know, you can go outside but you can't mingle, you can do this but you can do that, has the sort of ridiculousness of trying to regulate people's everyday lives to that degree been in any sense kind of challenged because of this experience? Or do you think it's all just going to carry on regardless, you know?
Well, the nanny state stuff, I think, will carry on regardless. I mean, all the so-called junk food advertising stuff and everything in the health and care bill to with food, that's all been brought in partly because of COVID, specifically because of Boris Johnson's COVID experience. No, I basically agree with what Dominic said to start with, that this has set a very dangerous precedent. I mean, we were saying this 2 years ago, you know, it's a huge risk that you make public health so kind of paramount. And my only hope, as I've said all along, is that the pandemic teaches people the difference between a public health issue and a private health issue. Because for too long, private health behaviors have been portrayed as public health issues when they're not. Obesity is not a public health issue. Smoking is not a public health issue. Drinking could be a public disorder issue, but that's about as far as a government should be concerned.
Especially if you
drink
Buckfast, imagine.
Right, yeah, especially in Scotland after minimum pricing. and I don't know whether people have got that. I think perhaps it's helped, you know, because we haven't really had a proper public health problem in this country for a long time, or certainly not a public health crisis, and COVID was one. And the fact that it was an infectious disease meant that different rules apply. And we can certainly argue about what those rules should have been, but you know, different rules apply because of the risk to others. But there isn't a risk to others from me getting fat or whatever, you know? So maybe we've reminded people of the distinction there, but I'm very concerned that that's not the way it's going to go. And actually the way it's going to go is you're going to have, you know, for example, Action on Smoking Health saying that, you know, we had 70,000 people die in 1 year from COVID, but more people than that die every year from smoking. And we locked down the country because of COVID. So what are we going to do about smoking? Let's lock down the smokers. I don't know. I'm not very optimistic, put it that way.
Excellent. Great. Dominic, Chris, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support the show, why not become a Spiked supporter? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.